and I am going to temporarily open a public hearing on House Bill 3156 to allow Mike McCollum a chance to give his testimony because he has other places to be and guess.
I won't be quick.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mike McCallum, the President and CEO of the Oregon Restaurant Association. Appreciate your consideration on the agenda today. We have a small food show going on up in Portland with about 15,000 people. I'm supposed to be up there this morning, so again, I appreciate your consideration. We're here today to talk about House Bill 3156. This is a bill that deals with the statewide food program in Oregon. With me today are Art Marshall and Judy Crane, two longtime members of the Restaurant Association, both past chairmen. They're also members of the State Food Service Advisory Committee and well prepared to give some comments on this. Currently, the statutes and the rules call for a state program, and these statutes and rules are pretty clear. The problems arise because we have literally 27 different entities in this state that are interpreting what, in fact, those statutes and rules are and forming programs around that interpretation. The program is a fee-supported program. Currently, I think that problems we're having with the program are illustrated by the fact that we've got fees that range as much as 100% from one another. So clearly the different counties and the state perhaps don't have as clear of consensus on what that program scope ought to be. I'm going to ask Art and Judy to just give a couple illustrations from their history of this problem, and then I'll talk again a little bit about our proposed solution to this. Judy?
Good morning. Through the years, I've seen numerous attempts at standardization of the food service inspection program.
Could you identify yourself for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Judy Crane. I operate Holman's Bar and Grill in Cortland. This is my first time, so pardon me if I'm nervous.
You're doing fine.
With the adoption in 2002 of the 1999 Food Code, the industry had hoped to finally see consistency in the application of code rules. Instead, what we've seen is a lack of uniformity in the interpretation of the new rules and a wide variation in the application of the fee structure. For example, when the state adopted the new food code, they opted for a double hand-washing standard instead of the use of gloves in bare-hand food contact situations. This is supposed to be the state rule. But some field inspectors are requiring the use of gloves by food service employees when they inspect a restaurant. This is not the rule. This is the inspector's decision, and it is confusing for both the operator and for the employees. These variations are particularly troublesome for multi-unit operators who have stores in more than one county. The corporate leadership develops standard operating procedures, which they give to all their operations, only to find that some of the counties have chosen to make their own rules, which contradict the state rules. There are similar inconsistencies in the application of the rules for plan design review, which means that new store designs are interpreted differently in different locations. Imagine how frustrating that is for multi-unit operators. We see large variations in the fee structure, too, from one county to another, and this makes us wonder if the program is the same and each county is operating under the same statutes, why is there a disparity in the fees? During my time on the various advisory boards, I've seen thousands of hours spent by both the industry and the regulatory agencies in trying to fix the current system. I personally spent many weeks on a scoring and inspection work group. This group was made up of people from the state health department, the county health departments, representatives from the Department of Agriculture, a representative from ORA, and operators. We met weekly for months to come up with recommendations for a new scoring system based upon the new food code. We were under a deadline because of the looming adoption date for that new food code, but we did do it. The result of our efforts was a very impressive multi-page document outlining our vision for a truly meaningful scoring system, one that was based on the principles of determining the actual risk factors for foodborne illness. It was a great report, and we were really proud of it, but it didn't do any good since it was never put into practice. Evidently, because the state didn't have the mechanism to compel implementation by the counties, it went nowhere. Don't get me wrong, I don't begrudge my time spent on these committees, but the thing is, I would like to see that something was happening as a result of the time that I've invested. I'm not alone as an operator investing my time in the system. What we want is a state-supervised system that whose goal is food safety for the dining public. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Art Marshall from the Portland area. I'm with Marshall Associates. I'm formerly operated my own restaurants and then chief operating officer of major multi-unit chain throughout the Northwest. I've been on the advisory committee for excess of 25 years with the state and have, as Judy, worked on just innumerable committees trying to bring things together so that we were partners in success, our inspectors and our operators. In this particular case, I think I'm a corporate analyst and a contract manager. And I just have to say that there isn't a corporation that could survive with 27 different heads trying to interpret the same set of codes. It just is inconsistent. And so the inconsistency Judy talked about, whether it be gloves, whether it be the way that we wear hair nets, all of the issues, all of the control issues are subject to interpretation. I'm going to go just a little bit different route. Over the years, I've sat down time and time and time again, even attending conferences in Bend and at the coast, and so forth with the different county folks, and there's always a separate political agenda, or almost always a separate political agenda and a specific interest that's diluting the general effort, so it confuses our operators. And as a multi-unit operator, I can tell you the absolute frustration I would have when I'd go from southern Oregon to the Portland area and from east to west and have different interpretations of the same code. We had, as a company, a standard training program. We had standard policies and procedures relevant to food safety. And then each county, we went in and we'd have to say, okay, how does ours apply with theirs? We knew we were in compliance with the state, but then we'd have to try and dart and weave and flex. So I'm a strong proponent of trying to bring this under some kind of central control and the cost efficiencies that come with it. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Dalto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question for Mr. McCallum. I got a letter from a constituent who is concerned that, quote, this bill eliminates local input and involvement in food safety issues. Just wanted to maybe have your response to that.
Yeah, let me talk a bit about our solution, because the bill in front of you, we're going to propose some amendments to. The bill there calls for a state program, but it would additionally allow the state to contract back with counties, and so there would still be county involvement from that perspective. Perceives one fee, one agency administering the program, a centralized billing system, one set of standards for the program. That's the bill in front of you. Frankly, the counties, and I believe the state as well, believe that's more draconian than we need to go to present this solution. And they've since come back and offered an alternative that I asked my board to consider yesterday. And this alternative would, in fact, call for annual intergovernmental agreements between the counties and the state for the implementation of this program. It would continue to allow the delegatory authority that Ms. Representative Dalto spoke of, but it would in fact tell them annually they'll be reviewed as to compliance with the statewide consistency and uniformity for the program. In addition, it talks about some other provisions around fee levels and frankly, complaint procedures and different things that we think will really make progress in moving this issue forward. Grant Higginson from the State Health Division and representatives from the counties are here to talk about that amendment as well. And I'll tell you that we are ready to work with them in finding a way to proceed in a consensus fashion on this bill. I do think that there's a few minor issues we've yet to discuss with them. We just saw their proposal last Thursday, but again, our board approved it in concept yesterday, and we're ready to move forward with the drafting of these amendments.
Any other questions?
Thank you very much for your consideration.
Drive safely.
Thank you.
I'm going to go ahead and complete this. Grant and Linda.
Good morning. Chair Cruz, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the State Public Health Officer with the Department of Human Services, and we're here today in support of House Bill 3156, which I do think will have substantial improvements to the food services program in the amended form that we're going to be talking about. The prevention of foodborne illness is a critical public health function, and it does need to be linked with our communicable disease control, and as we're seeing more and more linked to our bioterrorism response efforts as well. Consequently, we do believe that the place for the food services program is within public health, where we have a state-level agency that's providing overall coordination and oversight, and then the local delivery of services at the local level. You have heard some of the concerns that were voiced from the Restaurant Association and the industry, and we had heard those concerns as well. But in addition to hearing those concerns, this was an issue. The improvement of food services is an issue that we're concerned about in and of itself for public health. And so consequently, over the past 6 months, we have had a process going on where state health agency people have been working with local public health department folks to look at what are the values, what's the principles, what is the vision and mission for how food services should be provided in the state of Oregon. And as a piece of that work, we have periodically gone back to the Restaurant Association and said, here's the work we've been doing. Can we have your input? And as Mr. McCallum said, I think we've now come to a point where we are getting pretty close, and I think can in a couple of weeks work out some amendments that we hope will be consensus amendments for everybody. We do believe that there needs to be strong state oversight of the program to ensure that consistency. We also believe that there needs to be flexibility and input from the local level as well. We do believe, as I said, that we have had good faith efforts from all parties involved. I do want to thank the Restaurant Association and some of their industry representatives who have participated in our discussions. I also want to thank Chloe for their work. I believe that the amendments that we're going to be coming up with are going to reflect substantial compromises on both sides. As I mentioned, one of the key elements of the agreement that we're going to be coming to is the fact that at the central level, at the state level, we will have a strong food services program that is responsible for not only making sure that we're using good science-based principles like the FDA food code, but those principles are being applied consistently across all of the counties. The way that we're going to do that is change from the existing model that we've had in the past called delegation to one that's really an intergovernmental agreement, much more like a contract. There will be responsibilities. There will be deliverables on the county side. There will be roles and responsibilities on the state side. And that intergovernmental agreement will make sure that both of the parties are owning up to their responsibilities. As I mentioned, that we have been working together, and as Mr. McCallum said, we only had a meeting with all three groups present where we came to agreement. That was just a few days ago, and so what we're asking now is a little more time, up to a couple of weeks, to go back and beat out some actual amendments that we can all agree to and then bring it back to the committee. So thanks for hearing us today, and once again, I want to thank all the parties involved.
Thank you. Linda.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Linda Fleming. I'm the Executive Director of the Coalition of Local Health Officials. We represent Oregon's 34 local health departments. To support what Grant said, the objective of the Oregon State Food Program is the protection of the public's health and to reduce the incidence of foodborne illnesses. The scope and design of the local program is a little different possibly than that of the state because we work with multiple agencies in local service delivery. We deliver food safety by inspecting facilities. That not only includes licensed restaurants that you may be hearing about today, but also includes all school cafeterias in the state, all certified daycare centers in the state, adult foster care homes, mobile units, the taco stand and the hot dog stand you see on the corner in downtown Portland, temporary restaurants that are associated with fairs and rodeos and musical events. We also have some very community unique settings in which we have to do food protection. For example, in Jackson County last summer, there was a lot of work done by the local environmental health program with the fire camps to assure that the firefighters had safe food. You can't imagine what it would be like to have whole fire camps with an outbreak of foodborne illness. So at the local level, we are providing a program that is under the guidance of the health services in ORS 624. We're doing it under rules in the Department of Education. We're doing it under rules in the child care division. So it is a very broad service at the local level, of which, of course, restaurants are the core. In addition, we provide education of food service workers and community education. But bottom line, the real intent and scope of our program is the early identification and intervention of suspected foodborne illness using a team approach of public health nurses and environmental health specialists to control the outbreak. And this can only be done when it's done through the integrated agency at the local level. To that extent, we think local service delivery is responsible and responsive in its mission to protect the public's health and prevent communicable disease, including foodborne illness. As Grant said, we've undertaken in the last several months to do a review of the program, a very proactive review, not a reactive review. And out of that, we have found that there are successes in the food program that do need to be acknowledged. For example, a state and local data system has been developed to support strategic planning statewide and drive management decisions. The next step that needs to be implemented is better utilization of this data system. It's now in place. We have the data. We know how the system looks. Now we need to utilize the data to make some good management decisions to move this program forward. The state and the largest food program jurisdiction, which is Multnomah County, have participated in the FDA food program standards. I believe that they're two of only 28 jurisdictions in the nation that have agreed to do so. The preliminary findings is that Oregon exceeds most of the nation in the elements necessary for an efficient and effective food protection program. As has already been noted, Oregon adopted the 1999 FDA food program in January of 2002. The state has taken a very aggressive approach to assure that every environmental health specialist or registered sanitarian working at the county level is trained and standardized in its application. In a meeting we had with Mr. McCallum in June of 2002, it was acknowledged by both parties, all three parties, the state, the counties, and the restaurant association, that we're on a steep learning curve, both for the inspectors as well as for operators in terms of what it meant to change to that new food code. A dispute resolution protocol is in place for operators who dispute the rule interpretation during their inspection. Current statute requires a work plan for the program that includes industry in the development and the assessment of the effectiveness. But the most critical piece to us is that in most counties there's very close alignment of our environmental health programs with our communicable disease program and our bioterrorism response planning activities that we're undergoing now. That is just critical to us at the local level. Fees are required by statute to reflect true costs with identified elements, and with the exception of two counties, all the fees are within a normal range of one another. The Food Service Advisory Committees, our local Food Service Advisory Committees, as well as the State Food Service Advisory Committee, are required in statute for the assurance of input from the public and industry. Given we've recognized strengths, we also have recognized our weaknesses. We try to be objective in our assessment and evaluation of ourselves. The triennial review findings that the state conducts on every county have not resulted in enforcement of noncompliance and probation or loss of delegation, with the exception of one county in 1998. The dispute resolution process that I believe was put in place in, I believe, probably 1993 or 1995 has not been used. The food work plan has not been created with mission, values, and vision, but as a list of tasks. We are in the process now of changing that. However, the current work plan efforts are based upon the essential functions of public health and the FDA food program standards. So we anticipate a much better work plan reflective of industry and public health interest, both coming out in this next fiscal year. Food service advisory committees are not in place in every county, and those that have established one do not always utilize them to their full potential. adequate methods for assuring general public participation regarding food safety and policy development have not been achieved. Cost analysis of fees that deviate significantly from the mean are not undertaken when fees are established. There has not been a challenge of those fees. Inspections are not risk-based in the Oregon program, resulting in a lack of prioritization of inspections related to food safety risk. Result is an increasing workload rather than a workload that focus on risk-based priorities. And there is also inconsistent integration of communicable disease and environmental health functions within some local agencies. In particular, we have 10 counties that do not do the environmental health program. That has led to lack of a coherent linkage between local public health and the food inspection program because the state agency and the local agency aren't integrated at the local level, and so we have lost that communication link in those 10 areas. The solution, we believe, is as Mike McCallum and Grant have just have previously alluded to, is amendments to this bill that include elements and processes identified in the proposed set of attachments that I have to you titled the DHS CLO proposal for next set of improvements in the food protection program, March 2003. We did work on these on last Thursday with the Restaurant Association. We revised some of the elements at their request, and I'll briefly go through them with you again. As Grant said, we believe that the program should be developed through a system of local service delivery and strong state oversight and accountability. The program will be modeled after the 1999 FDA Food Code is adopted statewide in January 2002. It'll be risk-based, science-based, and data-driven. Delegation for local service delivery shall be to the local public health authority by intergovernmental agreement. Currently, once a county receives delegation, it's kind of like a county has received delegation. I believe Multnomah County signed their delegation agreement in 1976. It's never been revisited. We have other counties that signed it in 1974. It's never been revisited. We think it's time to bring environmental health into the current practice we have for all other public health programs, bring it into our annual plan, our annual contracting process, develop a scope of work, performance measures, etc. That's the way we're used to doing business in every other program, and we're willing to step up to the table and do business in that manner in this program as well. The IGA would be renewed annually as part of the agency's annual public health plan. The IGA shall identify the role and responsibility of the state authority, shall identify the role and responsibility, scope of work, and performance measures for which the local public health authority will be held accountable. It'll identify a process for assuring compliance with roles, responsibilities, and deliverables as required of both parties, and it shall also identify the establishment of local food service advisory committees as desired and appropriate in each local jurisdiction. Fees will be established using a cost-based formula. The state shall establish a range of fees by creating a marker fee, utilizing the cost elements allowed in the formula. Fees established by the local public health authority, that are 20% lower or 20% higher than the state marker shall cause a fiscal audit to be done by the state agency to verify that allowed cost elements were used in the fee-setting process, and fees as established are justified for solvency of the program. Again, I would remind you that this program is fee-supported, and there are a wide range of variables in counties. For example, Multnomah County must deliver this program in 12 separate languages. That is a big job. It's a big job. If you're going to prevent communicable disease, you have to be able to talk to the people in the language that they're operating their facility in. The state has authority to roll back fees to a level supported by the cost analysis in the event the fees are found to be in excess of the costs. The Conference of Local Health Officials and Oregon Restaurant Association will remain advisory to health services on issues pertaining to the food service program. Those are the context of the proposal that we agreed to on last Thursday that we would like to go forward with in some type of an amendment process.
Mr. Chair. Representative Tomei.
Thank you. Very impressive, Linda. Linda, how is the Oregon Coalition of Local Health Officials funded?
The Oregon Coalition of Local Health Officials is funded by dues from each county.
So will you have to increase dues to take on these added responsibilities?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, the coalition will not be taking on these added responsibilities. This will be a part of the established food service program between the state and local health departments. The coalition, our primary function is around education, those types of things. So the coalition will not be increasing its fees to counties for this work.
If I can follow up then to Grant, then move.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, this will be part of the public health services delivered by the state and local partnership. And the funding from those services come from a variety of different sources. There's a small amount of general fund that goes through us directly to the counties to provide some core public health services. There are then a lot of grant dollars, particularly from the federal government, that come through us to support particular activities at the county level. And then there are a number of fee-supported programs, and the food service program is a fee-supported program. So if there are additional costs that will be required, those are something that will be borne by additional fees. And this is something that we have been working with the Restaurant Association on. They, while they can't say are overjoyed at the idea of increased fees for their members, are willing to have some increase in those fees if indeed it is going to provide a stronger, more consistent program across the state.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What two counties you identified that are out off the mark on fees, or not off the mark, but are different?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mona Sanderson, the lowest fee is charged by Marion County, and the highest fee is charged by Deschutes County.
Mm-hmm.
And it's those fees that the Restaurant Association says when there's a 100% difference in fees, that's where you can see it. As was also mentioned by one of the speakers, when you look at the vast majority of the counties, they do very much cluster right around what the state fee is right now. So there's some outline, and as we said, you know, that needs to be checked to see why do we have that degree of difference, and is that justified, and if it's not, bring it back into line.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moses Anderson, I'd also like to address that. Also, we need to, there's a range of fees, and the restaurant fees established by the state in statute are based on seating. So from 0 to 15, there's one fee. From 16 to 50, there's another fee. It's based on seating. So also, when you say there's a 100% discrepancy in fees, a coffee shop that has 15 seats is obviously going to pay a lot less than a major restaurant with over 151 seats. So that might be part of it. But when we looked at the proposal we have here and put the 20% marker in, we found two counties that would fall into that automatic trigger of a fiscal audit. Interestingly enough, one of them was Marion County, that's 20% below the state fee at the current point, and Deschutes County, that's 20% above. So we have two counties that fall outside that, what we would consider a normal curve.
It would be all of
what is the number? I mean, is it a range of fees, then, you're saying, depending on how many seats they have? I was just
Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson.
Number.
Yeah, I do have that information that I can get to you what the fees are in each county. But yes, fees are established based on seating, and there are breaks in the seating that are established actually in statute, and the fees are based on that. So, as I said, there's a lower fee for 0 to 15, and then it goes up to 151 plus. But I can get that information for you.
Thank you. Yeah. Another question. Judy Crane mentioned an advisory group or a group, and I wanted to have both of your inputs as to what you thought of that document that Judy felt was very good, and why wasn't anything done with it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, on the first piece, the advisory committee, there is a state food services advisory committee, which we find very valuable at the state level. That committee is made up of representation from CLO, Conference of Local Health Officials, from the industry, from the Restaurant Association, from the general public, and from state agency staff. And one of the things that we have come to agreement upon statewide, I think everyone agrees on this, is that we we really want to move towards the FDA food standards. That was something that was recommended by the advisory committee. That's something that we're moving towards. As she said, Multnomah County has now adopted those. That's something that we want to move forward statewide as well, and we're thinking that the amendments that come back to you are going to allow a system where we can move those things forward. So we have made some progress. We aren't as far along as I would hope to be, but we're confident that this change in the food service program will lead us that way. Food service committees, advisory committees, are also required of counties as well. One thing we've found is that there's really, though, only a handful of counties that have them right now. Some of them are strong, some of them aren't so strong. And in our discussions on Thursday, rather than saying that we want to see one of these in every county, we want to make sure that there's good input from both the public and from the industry into the food services program, and not just in the state level and in the metro level, but around the state. But how we're going to get to that is something, again, we need to work on a little bit more before we come back with a recommendation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, I believe you also addressed that question to me, and I'll be quite frank, I think it boils down to an issue of accountability and responsibility. I think that both counties and the state were not held accountable to making these happen, as was the Restaurant Association in terms of the dispute resolution process. So I think that there are accountability issues that can be shared by all of us, that we are willing to step up to the plate through an intergovernmental agreement and say it's time to end.
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm wondering if you're costing out by seating, then, so the taco stands on a corner and out in my district in Hillsborough area, there's a lot of the taco trucks out there. Are those inspected, and are they charged the lowest fee because they have no seats, or how does that work?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barker, mobile units and temporary restaurants have a separate fee, and they are not based on seating. They are based on the type of operation.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Barker, if I can add, we will get that fee schedule of all the fees for the different categories of restaurants, for temporary facilities, and for beneficial organizations as well to the committee.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Representative Anderson, excuse me.
I've had instances where local restaurateurs have come and felt that the local body was not doing a fair job in evaluating the needs that they had, and they wanted to go directly to the state and bring in inspection. Do I understand that this local public health authority would be an intermediary, a peer review in some way to adjudicate problems between the local institution there and their public health authority?
You can go first.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, no, I think that what we are proposing is that there be strong state oversight. There is currently a protocol in place that allows an operator who disputes their inspection to go directly for the state for dispute resolution. That process has never been used. We are supporting a program that establishes strong state oversight and allows for review of those instances where there is resolution, dispute to be resolved.
So this bill would really strengthen the ability for the state to adjudicate those problems.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, the amendments that we are proposing, we believe, address it.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, if I could add, you know, the way we would like to see it happen most awfully is local to local coordination and cooperation. So my hope is that the first thing that would happen if a restaurant had a problem would be to take it to the local health department. One thing, though, that we have heard from the restaurant is that the Restaurant Association is that they would like to have a system where they could have one point of contact, that if a restaurant's having a problem, that they would be able to bring it there. And we have that said, that we at the state level will certainly agree to serving in that role, so that a restaurant could bring it to us. Of course, the first thing we would do then would take it to the local health department and try to get them working it out together. But I do think that, that the strengthening of the central role and the central accountability here would make it much more likely that something is going to happen if there indeed is a problem.
Thank you very much. I want to thank everybody that's been working on this, and I guess my only concern here, Dr. Higginson, is with your 2 weeks when we look at President Courtney's Senate schedule. We may need to. I would suggest that we expedite this as quick as we possibly can, so it actually has a chance to get to the Senate before they shut down, if indeed they're going to do that. And we will have amendments coming back. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on 3156, and I'm going to open the public hearing on 2996. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2996 is modifying the current language for the State Board of Denture Technology. It's limiting a person to 2 consecutive terms as a member of that board, and it's allowing a reappointment to the board after a 3-year hiatus or absence. And we have some folks from the technology board here to speak to the bill.
Yes.
Excuse me. And attached, you have some written testimony of folks that was attached here, SMS, of folks that wanted that submitted that couldn't be here to testify in person.
Joe, Tad, and Sean. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, representatives of the committee. My name is Joe Koss, and I come before you today to speak in favor of House Bill 2996, which modifies Oregon statute that currently limits members of the Board of Denture Technology to 2 consecutive 3-year lifetime terms. House Bill 2996 would allow board members to be reappointed to serve additional terms after a 1-term absence. I believe that by removing lifetime term limits, House Bill 2996 will allow the Board of Denture Technology to better represent the public and the denturist profession. Let me state for the record that I am currently serving my first term as a citizen member of the Board of Denture Technology. As such, I am familiar with the issues and activities of the board. I am not, however, speaking to you today as a representative of that board. Denturism has been recognized as a profession in Oregon since 1979. The Board of Denture Technology was established to be the regulatory body for that profession. The board consists of 4 denturists, 2 citizen members, and 1 dentist. As I said before, current law restricts board participation to 2 consecutive 3-year terms. While for many such boards this restriction works well, such is not the case for the Board of Denture Technology, primarily because of the size of the denturist profession in Oregon. There are just over 100 licensed denturists to practice in Oregon, most of which have been practicing for over 20 years. Of that number, more than 25% have already served their lifetime limit on the Board of Denture Technology. Taking into consideration that not every denturist is interested in serving on the board as a member, it has therefore become increasingly difficult to find willing, capable denturists representing a variety of varying geographic areas of the state to serve on the board. With the passing of Ballot Measure 24, Oregon denturists have an expanded scope of practice that now includes both full and partial dentures. The Board of Denture Technology is now beginning to consider how the state will ensure that consumer safety is maintained within this expanded scope of practice. While the rules may be established within a relatively short time, it will likely be years before everyone concerned will be completely comfortable with denturism as it now exists. Active board participation by mature, experienced, and wise denture professionals would be a great value during this time. We should not continue to exclude individuals, many of whom would like to again serve on the board, simply by virtue of term limits. I therefore ask you to look favorably upon Bill 2996 and send it on with a due pass recommendation. Thank you for your attention, and I will now be happy to answer any questions that you may have that I can.
Yeah, why don't we do all the testimony then, and we'll field any questions.
Very good.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the board. My name is Sean Murray. I'm a licensed denturist in the state of Oregon, obviously. I have served my two terms at the Board of Denture Technology. The reason I felt the need to serve my terms is that I want to be politically active in my profession. And now, after I've done that, I no longer can serve. I now have a voice in my profession and cannot be active in that policy-making board to protect the denturist and the public. So I think it's really important that we pass this bill, because some of us would like to continue to serve. Our group is very small. A lot of the denturists do not want to serve because they're not politically inclined to do so. So it really limits the number of people that are possible to serve on the board. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair Cruz and committee members. My name is Tad Brzezinski. I am a denturist in the Deschutes County area. I am also serving on the board currently, my first term as well. And again, being a younger denturist, I have, I think, a long future here in this business, and would also like to be able to have that opportunity, possibly years down the road, to also have my voice on that policymaking board, as my terms are coming up at this point in time. So I would again ask for your support to eliminate these term limits, so that at some time in the future I may also have that opportunity, as well as other young denturists that are starting their terms on this board as well. Bottom line, I thank you for your time and go from there.
Any questions? Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How are you appointed, or you send in an application and say, I want to be on the board, or how does that?
I can address that, Chairman Cruz and Representative Mona Sanderson. We do, for interest, fill out an application. If you are interested to be on that board, and then it is, you are appointed by the governor through the appointing process.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. I know that I've been an opponent of term limits for a long time, so so this fits in well with me. So, do we have any problems here? Okay. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2996. I'm going to open the work session on House Bill 2996. Representative Balto.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2996 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Dalton moves House Bill 2996 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll.
Representative Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Parker.
Excused.
Representative
Dalton.
Aye.
Representative
Montague.
Aye.
Representative
Tomei.
Aye.
Aye.
Mr. Chair, I move this bill to the consent calendar.
Okay. Representative Tomei moves House Bill 2996 to be placed on the consent calendar. Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. And House Bill 2996, having received the required majority, is declared passed. And we will close the work session on House Bill 2996 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2463. And colleagues, this is one of the health plan bills that when I mentioned last week we were going to be hearing some issues that were kind of outliers to the main body of work. This is one of them. The purpose of this hearing is to kind of get a feel for scope of things. So with that, we'll just go right into testimony, and I'll call up Tom, Mickey, and Reynold.
Thank you.
Since you're all from DHS, I figured you could probably get along well enough for a short period of time to sit together.
Chair Cruz and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mickey Cerise. I'm special assistant to the assistant director for children, adults, and families. That's the cluster within DHS that provides the program and policy support for child welfare and self-sufficiency programs. We're here this morning to give the committee some information regarding House Bill 2463. And to help with the context of this, I'm going to refer you to, in the bill, specifically Section 3, Sub 2, that first sentence. And we are unclear as to how broad of a net that particular sentence, that sentence would cast in referrals going from DHS to the district attorney's office. So what we want to do is provide you some information on how we handle fraud cases, both for clients and for providers. And I have with me this morning Tom Fisher, who is manager for our fraud investigations unit for clients, and I have Ren Patala, who is a fraud investigator. And following us will be Joan Kapowicz, who will give you some information on provider fraud, and we also have representatives from the District Attorneys Association and DOJ to offer their input. So I will turn this over to Tom.
Chair Cruz and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here. This is my first time testifying. I've worked for the department for 25 years, and this is exciting to be here, so thank you very much. In the
since you're a rookie, we'll give you a little bit here, but you do have to give us your name for the record.
Tom Fisher.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. In the genesis of the investigation unit, the Welfare Fraud Investigation Unit, we came out of the old Adult and Family Services, and now we serve the department. We have 13 investigators that are stationed throughout the state, and they will investigate instances of potential client fraud. So, for example, last year, we had about 3,000 referrals of welfare fraud that came to our unit. Most of these came from case managers throughout the state. Some came from citizens and some from a few other sources. And of that 3,000 cases, about 500 of them had to do with Oregon Health Plan fraud. And so of those 500 Oregon Health Plan fraud cases that we did a preliminary investigation on, we found about 175 of them were substantiated. And of that 175, 10 went to prosecution, where we worked with the local district attorney on prosecuting those cases. We have some criteria that is more of the guidelines for when we work with the local district attorney on prosecution cases, and it varies somewhat throughout the state depending upon the workload of the local district attorney and their willingness to take on cases. One of those guidelines is a case that exceeds $2,500. Is one that we'll be talking with the local DA on. Or if we have cases that we've got actually a signed application during that fraudulent period of time where it was an obvious intent to deceive during that period of time, we'll work with the DA on those cases. So with me is Ren Catala, who's an investigator out of the Albany area, and we thought it might be helpful for him to give you an example or two of the types of cases that we work on.
Good morning, Chair Cruz, members of the committee. My name is Ren Catala, and I'm a fraud investigator for the Fraud Investigations Unit, and my area of assignment is the Linn County, Benton County, and Lincoln County areas. So today I'd just like to give you some ideas about the investigations that I work on, and specifically Medicaid investigations, the Oregon Health Plan. Basically, Mr. Fisher just stated, the cases come to us from the field, case managers or case workers that come upon suspicious information regarding potential fraud, or we actually get a complaint from the community regarding information that they know of, and would like the state to look into the allegation. So some of the things we look at are household composition. Is the client reporting correctly on the application regarding that? It could be a variety of things. Are they an Oregon resident? Where do they live as far as residency is concerned? Income levels, which is a key eligibility factor for that program on income. And part of my job is to, or actually the whole part of my job is to determine the course of action that the state is going to take regarding the resolution of these cases, whether it be civil or criminal referral to the local district attorney's office. And as Tom said, our general cutoff is $2,500 in unlawfully obtained public assistance, in this case, Medicaid. So, any questions that Mr. Chair has or any members of the committee would be happy to answer those.
Yeah, but I have a question.
Sure.
Are you able to resolve some of these by meeting with folks who might have just made a mistake and have them pay back what it is that they owed the state?
Yes, Vice Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Tomei, some of these cases are the result of client error, inadvertent error made on behalf of the client. Some errors are made on behalf of administrative errors in the agency itself, and others are fraud, outright fraud. So we look at those areas to see which is the most appropriate course to take on what the cases that we're looking at.
So you have a judgment call at some point that this is deliberate fraud and this was maybe client error. Is that correct?
Yeah, we look at the evidence on what we have, applications, interview witnesses, documents submitted on behalf of the client or by the client, and we look at the totality of the circumstances. Mm-hmm. Do you want to add to that, Tom?
No, I think that's very accurate.
Any other questions? Or am I sensitive?
Thank you, Madam Chair. In trying to understand the verbiage here, does this mean that fraud could be, I mean, it seems like the focus is on the individual, but what about the people who bill it, a physician or a hospital, or what about an employee who might do some fraud within the Medicaid billing? I mean, does this bill include them also?
Madam Chair and Representative Moniz Anderson, this bill, my understanding is this bill does cover the provider piece of your comment. I don't know if it covers employees that might do some fraudulent work. I would have to defer that question to one of our legal representatives here.
Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Okay, Ellen Sternfield and Dennis Shen, please.
Okay. I have no idea what this is.
Would you give us your names for the record, please?
Sure. Good morning. My name is Mike McCormick, and I'm an audit manager with the Department of Human Services.
My name is Joan Kapowich, and I work with the Program and Policy Section of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs.
And we're here similarly to the previous DHS employees to give you an overview of what we currently do in this area in the Department of Human Services. So I'll just start with that, and then we can answer any questions. The Office of Medical Assistance Programs and the Director's Office, where Mike McCormick works, both are involved in this program. We look at the element of provider fraud or submitting erroneous or billings. At one point in time, the Office of Medical Assistance Programs had an audit unit, and then it did transfer several years ago to the Director's Office, so that work is compiled there. We use an information systems review of all billings to look for problematic areas. In addition, we take phone calls from communities or other kinds of tips, and those are referred for the auditors to look at and to evaluate and review the billing information to see if there's a problem. And I'll let Mike go into that in more detail. We also have managed care contractors who are similarly charged with looking at problems that they might see in terms of billing. They each have to have a program integrity or compliance officer. They have to have policies and procedures established on how they will handle this kind of work. Both of our offices work closely with the Department of Justice. We have a memorandum of understanding about how we would refer problematic or suspicious claims or patterns of claims by a provider or group to the Department of Justice to investigate, because they are really the ones that can establish whether or not fraud, which is really a legal definition, has occurred or not, and pursue any kind of criminal investigation after that time.
And just a little bit of information on the Medicaid audit section. We have 5 full-time employees devoted to auditing fee-for-service providers in the Medicaid program. Most of our audits involve problems with documentation, not true fraud. When we do find true fraud, we refer them up to the Department of Justice Medicaid Fraud Control Unit for them to make the determination on whether or not to pursue a case for prosecution. We collect a substantial amount of overpayments each biennium. We project to collect approximately $3.7 million all funds, $1.5 million general fund. We conduct, you know, approximately 200 audits per biennium.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Okay, Vice Chair, Representative Tomei, I'd like to try to address Representative Moines Anderson's previous question. It's my reading of the bill, and I'm not a lawyer, that an individual who might be submitting a false claim on behalf of a provider would be covered by this, but that might be a good question to ask someone from the Department of Justice. Alan Sternfield's here, or one of the later people willing to testify who is an attorney. So.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, am I going to try again for Alan Sternfield and Dennis Shen? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ellen Sternfield. I am the attorney in charge of the Medicaid Fraud Unit of the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here with Dennis Chen from the Multnomah County District Attorneys Association. The Medicaid Fraud Unit of the Oregon Department of Justice is Oregon's federally required Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. We are vested with authority under federal law to investigate and prosecute cases involving Medicaid providers or employees of Medicaid providers who fraudulently submit bills to the Medicaid program. We're required by federal law to screen those cases both for criminal prosecution, and then if criminal prosecution is not appropriate, then for civil pursuit under state or federal civil laws. We do use both the state criminal statutes and the federal criminal statutes and available state and federal civil statutes. Our focus is provider fraud. We are not permitted under federal law to handle a case involving recipient fraud unless the recipient is in conspiracy with a Medicaid provider. So we do a number of those cases a year, but they're usually in conjunction with a provider. If it's strictly a recipient fraud, most of those cases are handled by the District Attorneys Association, and Mr. Chen will talk about it in a minute. The Department of Justice does not have a position on HB 2463. In essence, it's, our position is one of benign neutrality. I want to give you a little bit of history on the statutory schemes that exist and what exists now, and that may explain the position. For a number of years and still in existence were ORS 411-630 and 411-640, which are unlawfully obtaining public assistance and unlawfully receiving public assistance. There was also ORS 411-675, submitting a wrongful claim for health care payments. These were and are criminal statutes that are still on the books. They are C felonies. With the advent of the Oregon Health Plan in 1995, the Department of Justice proposed and the legislature enacted the statutory scheme under ORS 165.690, filing a false claim for health care payment. This statute addresses both recipient fraud and provider fraud under the Oregon Health Plan, and as well including fee-for-service. My unit has now had significant experience in utilizing the statute in courts throughout the state. The statute, at our suggestion, suggestion provided for a number of issues that were not addressed in prior statutes, for example, aggregation of claims. Before, in order to charge, for example, a Medicaid provider who wrongfully submitted health care claims, each individual claim was a separate C felony, which led to sometimes counts of 300 and 400 charges against a doctor or a dentist or a laboratory. And using the new statute, we're able to aggregate the claims under one filing. We were successful both through judges and judicial determination and then through the Oregon Justice Commission, and having ORS 165.690 classified with an offense severity of 6 as a public fraud as opposed to a property crime, and that's led us to some very significant sentences we believe that serve a very significant deterrence practice. Unlike the DHS, we do not have a minimum figure that we use before we charge a case. And we do that deliberately because, for example, in Multnomah County, sometimes a $10,000 fraud may not be significant, where in Jefferson County that may be quite significant. And so we screen and judge our cases based upon where we can have the most impact and the type of deterrence impact the cases may have. So we deliberately do not have a minimum amount that we will use. But we do screen our cases, and I believe there were some questions to this regarding whether or not there was deliberate fraud or there may have been a misinterpretation or misapplication of the rules, and we do therefore consider the evidence that is at issue in the case. ORS 165.69.
I'm stuck on that 10,000. You mean that would not be significant enough to follow up?
Oh, it would be. I'm sorry, but for example, in Multnomah County, a $10,000 case may not lead to more than a 60-day sentence, whereas in Jefferson County, it could lead to a significant sentence. And in Multnomah County, it might not make the papers. In Jefferson County, it would make the papers. The impact of the cases is different. We do file cases of $10,000, of $5,000, of $300. We sometimes spend more on prosecuting the cases than we will recover in a judgment on the case, but we judge the cases because of the deterrence impact prosecution will have. In our mind, the worst thing that can happen is we uncover a deliberate fraud. The worst message you can send, that if you get caught, all that happens is you have to pay the money back, because that only will encourage that person as well as any other person to continue committing the fraud, and that's not the message our unit wants to send anywhere around the state.
Got it. Thank you very much.
ORS 165.690 is also a RICO predicate statute, so that we can charge, if we do have a deliberate scheme involving an organized activity, can charge a racketeering offense involving ORS 165.690. We have also worked with U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office of Inspector General, which recognizes this statute as a basis to exclude providers or employees nationwide from participating as providers in the Medicare or Medicaid program. So if someone is convicted, for example, an employee of a nursing home is convicted of billing fraud, they go into a nationwide databank and cannot work in this capacity anywhere in the United States for a certain period of time because of those exclusion provisions under federal law. We have been very happy with ORS 165.690. It's been upheld on a number of appeals. It's been a very good statute to work with. We pursue providers, employees, recipients where appropriate, and we still utilize sometimes the statutes that are still on the book under Chapter 411. And it's because of our successes in this area that we don't view a new statutory scheme as necessary.
Thank you.
I'd like to, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Dennis Shen for the Multnomah County DA's office. As Ellen indicated, the district attorney's office is a recipient-focused fraud perspective with respect to these sorts of things. And our position is essentially neutral, but I'd like to offer observations from the trenches. To echo Ellen, I believe that 165.690, in particular 692, covers almost all of 2643. There are some differences. 162.690 698 offers, excuse me, I've got a cold, offers the notice requirements and, as Ellen indicates, offers the ability to aggregate, whereas 2463, get that right, does not. The other thing that 2463 adds is the enhancement language on B, and that's usually viewed as a good thing. However, 2463 is defined in terms of in subsection 2, sub 1, as presenting the information. And my experience has been that if there's any kind of threat that is made, it is after the claim has been denied or in the processing of the claim, not when the claim is actually filed. That's merely a paper transaction, and usually it's in the mail, it's through an employer, and there aren't any threats made. So the crime has already, arguably, already happened. And so you're not going to reach the enhancement if you can. And anecdotally, I haven't seen much of the threats, either physical threats or threatened physical threats. Perhaps there is information on there. I've spoken to Ellen, and she's not. It is not her experience either that that's an issue. Obviously, that can be defined more broadly to include the presenting of the claim information or any part of the processing of the claim, all the way to appeal of the claim. The other concern the district attorney's office has is a section that has already been alluded to, subsection 3, subsection 2, and that is the referral to the shall report the information to an appropriate agency. And as and has already been alluded, DHS apparently has an internal limit of $2,500, and those are the cases that they work, and then I didn't do the percentage on that, but a small percentage end up making it to the district attorney's office. But 2463 indicates that all of these apparently shall be reported to an appropriate agency. So the concern is that we'll get a flood, and the referral agency apparently is the district attorney's office, which is not an investigative body. So our concern is that we will be flooded with any time that there is any kind of information that might lead them to believe that. And we want to make sure that the appropriate agency is not the district attorney's office, is it police agency or maybe perhaps DOJ for what they do. And it could be that the reported information are those things or are those investigations that are done that they've deemed to be appropriate for referral to for prosecution rather than any kind of information. That's all I have for now.
Okay. Yeah, and we've had discussion on that language, and I'm not. I think this is one of those things where you can have two lawyers in the room and get three opinions, basically, because the appropriate agency could be still at this level, DHS, simply because that's the rules that are set up there. So. But if we're going to move something like this, we probably need to be a little clearer. So, any questions? Thank you very much. Ed. And for the record, we also have a letter that you received from the Oregon Medical Association. Please go ahead.
Good morning. My name is Ed Johnson from Lincoln County. And I do have one concern with the bill. I'm not against this bill, but the one concern I really have is that I like to see with the insurance company and their workers if they're involved in misappropriation of filing or going after somebody, that they be accountable for the same penalties as well, because it's not fair that anybody should be falsely or misinterpreted, be accused, and have to pay for an attorney and go through all this expenditure at their expense when they're innocent. It's not fair for the agencies to be above the law. And that's the one thing in the state of Oregon, the agencies have been above the law, and it's time we make the agencies accountable for the citizens of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ed. Any questions? Thank you. going to close the public hearing on 2463 and open the public hearing on 2987. Sandy?
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2987 is permitting an insurance carrier to impose a waiver of coverage for one or more pre-existing conditions for a limited time period for individuals accepted for individual health benefit plan coverage. It has a sunset date of January 2, 2008. It revises the premium rates charged to small employers. It's allowing carriers to apply premium participation credit if all eligible employees enroll in a health benefit plan. And we have...
Okay. Okay, we'll start off with Leonard, John, and Dennis.
Can Ruth, she come up as well?
Yes, she can. Okay, I didn't read over to the right far enough. My fault. 2987. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. With me is Dennis Tierney, Ruth Bauman Rogers, and Lynn Hagen from the company. Ruth and Dennis are actuaries. Lynn's a lawyer, and I just hang around them. The bill, as ably pointed out by your staff, does three things. The first, the bold print on page one, is the new language that adds the potential of a waiver to an individual policy, and Lynn will explain that in more detail later. Then over on page four of the printed bill, lines 11, 12 through 15, deal with the rate banding in small group policies. And at the bottom of that same page is a section that allows a discount in small group policy for employers that have 100% of their employees on a policy. And Mr. Chairman, members, with that, I would just turn it over to Mr. Hagen to go through the flip charts that he's prepared for you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. What I thought I would do first with this bill is give you some history, and then what I'd like to do is kind of paint a broad picture of the current market. We call it the small market, small group policies and individual policies. The history of this is last summer, Regents worked with a couple of plans to develop a list of different things that we felt would improve the viability of this small market. We were just starting to undergo that process, and as you're all aware, we ran into Measure 23. We kind of focused on Measure 23 for a while, came back to small market reform because we feel it's still necessary. And if anything, maybe Measure 23 kind of brought to bear or awareness the trouble of the small market and the insurance coverage. The consensus building process, and I'm on page two of my slides, what we tried to do was come up with elements that would help, again, create more viability in this small market, for which we were hoping to get consensus agreement. Several items fell off the list, and what you see before you in 2987 are really the three components that John mentioned that had the greatest level of consensus or agreement, and that's the waiver, the credit, and the rate bands. The current market, and I'm going to go to page three. The population number, I'm not sure it's completely accurate. It's the number we have, 3.7 million Oregonians. You can see from the pie chart, Regents insures around 30% of the market, other insurers around 57%, and the uninsured number ranges from 12 to 14%. We see different numbers on that. The market movement, I wanted to...
Just for clarification, yes. other insurers would include the state. That would include health plan, correct?
I do not think so.
believe it's only 15% uninsured. Yeah.
Oh, you're
okay.
Yes.
Just for clarification, yes. So we totally define the universe here. Okay.
Yes, it would. What I wanted to do is also talk about movement of the market. And these numbers in these slides were taken from filed numbers with DCBS. And I wanted to just visualize them. So starting in 1998, if you look through 2002 in the individual market, there's been roughly in the last 4 years a 10% decline of people being covered or enrolling into the individual market. If we go to page 4, the small employers, we see a similar decline, a little more significant. We had roughly a little more than 280,000 in 98, and roughly a 15% decline in that market in as of 2002, the end of, I believe it was September 2002. The large employer market has been fairly stable with a 1% decrease. But I wanted you to get the picture that this small market, the individual and small group employers, is a declining market and needs some stabilization. A recent Mercer survey that I saw reported in the Oregon Health Forum, haven't looked at the survey and the complete survey, but it's reporting that for 2003, we're seeing nationwide employer premium increases of around 13%, and I've seen numbers ranging from 12 to 15%. In Oregon, they're reporting that Oregon is going to be the highest in the nation, along with Southwest Washington, at 18.3% increase for 2003.
Why would Southwest Washington be a carve-out of the state of Washington?
Mr. Chair, why it would be different than the rest? I haven't looked at the full report, so I'm not sure why they've carved Southwest Washington out.
Okay. Just the curiosity.
Or why it's subject to a higher,
right.
Higher rate. Employers and insurance, the bottom of 5. Just some statistics. 70% of Oregonians under 64, those older are usually under Medicare, receive insurance from employers. The intent of that number is to show you that we're largely an employer-driven healthcare covered system. 97% of large employers offer insurance. 55% of all employers offer insurance. And 45% of employers with fewer than 50 employees offer insurance. And on this note, I wanted to share with you a personal story that was told to me by a CEO of Garden Valley Corporation out of Sutherland. Mark Sterner is the CEO, and he was telling me just several months ago that several years ago he used to insure, he's a small employer, ranges from 10 to 15 employees. He used to provide full health coverage for his employees and was a great benefit. A few years ago he had to decide whether or not he should cut out the dependents, not the spouses but the kids. And he made that decision to do so because of premium increases. Then last year he had to make the decision to cut spouses off so it would just be employees. Now he's faced with the decision of whether or not to purchase any coverage for his employees as premiums continue to increase. And I don't think he's alone in that story, but that's one that was told to me.
Mr. Chair.
Good friend of Mona Sanderson.
Thank you. I had a similar story. One of my the chains that are located in Gresham was saying that they used to cover 80% of the premium, and now they're only covering 20% of the premium. So it goes both ways. And so many of the people, especially at these chain food stores, aren't able to have any, and so they just don't buy any at all.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, that's correct, and I think what we're seeing is a couple of different things, and the example you gave is another way employers are handling these increases, and that's to push more costs on the employees, to keep the coverage, to make it available. I also wanted to just mention a few things about the uninsured, because as premiums increase and employers drop coverage or individuals can't afford it, they have a choice to make. They can get into the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool or elect to have no coverage at all, and they fall into the group of the uninsured. Roughly nationwide, there are 40 million uninsured individuals. $14 million would qualify for government-sponsored programs. $13 million have family incomes of greater than $50,000 a year, and the fastest-growing segment of the uninsured population is those with incomes of greater than $75,000 a year. So you can see the point of that is the uninsured issue. As premiums continue to increase, it affects more and more people. In Oregon, we have roughly 400,000 uninsured. Many are working families. And this is a statistic that I think is very important for us to remember. For every 1% premium increase, over 3,000 Oregonians lose coverage.
Okay.
And that's really an extrapolation from a national statistic that states, or was shown by the Lewin Group, a national consulting company, that for every 1% increase, roughly, I think it was 3 million Americans lose coverage. So we're roughly 1% of the population, and that's how the extrapolation was used for that statistic. On that point, again, for every 1% premium increase, we know that roughly 3,000 lose coverage. This session alone, when we think about what we're doing here in Salem, the mandates that are currently will be before you in the form of introduced bills would represent roughly 10% premium increase. That's not including the 15 to 18% increase that employers are going to see from other market factors. Components of 2987, we've mentioned the waiver, that's individual policies, and then the rate bands and participation credit. I'll briefly explain each one of those to you. I'm on the bottom of page 7 of the slides. Condition-specific waiver. Currently, it's not permitted in Oregon. So the current choices for an insurance carrier are either based on the health statement, and again, we're talking individual now, to either accept that person or reject them. If they're rejected, they can go to OMIP, the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, which is the high-risk pool, so there's no medical underwriting there. Or if they don't want to pay the premium, they can become uninsured and not. They can make the decision not to purchase coverage. HB 2987 would permit a waiver of a specific condition. It would only apply up to 24 months. There's also and the individual would retain the right to treat the conditioned offer or an offer of coverage subject to this waiver as a declination of coverage. What that means is the individual gets one more choice. They can either accept the coverage with the waiver, or they can reject the offer, and same as before, or they can still treat that as a rejection and go to OMIP. So now the insured has the three choices. It's another choice for the individual that they don't have now. It's either accept or reject. And what we would like to see health plans have the ability, or another arrow in the quiver, so to speak, for the individual market, is to say we will cover you subject to this condition. Now the individual has another choice. They can either accept that offer or still go to OMIP. And the 24-month limit. There's also a sunset clause for this particular provision of, I believe it's January 2008.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. I'm assuming that some of these conditions that the insurance company might want a waiver on would be something like diabetes, cancer. What else?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, the what else would depend on the there are no restrictions on what the what else might be. It'll be based on the health underwriting statement, the individual health statement. So if anybody else would care to add, it's not narrowed to any specific condition. It couldn't be. Now, the way this is drafted, it could not be. A carrier couldn't come up with a whole list and say, we're going to apply waivers for these conditions, carte blanche, because it has to be based on that individual's health statement.
Mr. Chair and Representative Tomei, if I might, the ability to add a waiver for a limited period of time, in this case 24 months, and then the waiver would disappear, is to... as Lynn pointed out, to give the consumer one more choice of taking a policy in the normal marketplace with this waiver, or using it as a declination and going where they would go today, and that is to the high-risk pool. Choices may be a bad knee, a ski injury, had it operated on last year. The insurer may put a waiver on that condition for this period of time. It could be cancer. In that case, this amendment would still allow that person to go to OMIP, or the high-risk pool, for that coverage. And that's why the high-risk pool, that's why insurers are assessed so much more than the premium paid by the individuals in that pool. I don't know whether the committee's had a full introduction on OMIP, but the premium is established by the board. That premium then is subsidized by quarterly assessments against health insurers by market share. And that assessment is very large. It's in millions of dollars a year. And this amendment here would simply allow a choice. If somebody wanted coverage for their family on an individual basis and they wanted to waive something for a 24-month period, this would give them that opportunity to do it. So it wouldn't be, it's not requiring something of them or taking away options that they currently do not have. It's just adding one more option. You can have this policy at this premium rate with this waiver for 24 months, or you can go to OMI.
May I follow up?
Yeah.
So, John, what would prevent the insurance company in 24 months after the waiver is over of just dropping the insurance?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tomei, the policies are on a guaranteed renewable basis as long as you're... Yes.
Okay.
The only way an insurance company would cancel is if they totally withdrew from the marketplace.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Do you have a sense of the impact something like this would have on OMIP? I mean, there's a lot of assumptions that have to go into that, but
are we
going to get into that? Or?
Well, Mr. Chairman, that is a good question. That's one of the reasons for the sunset, is that we want to try this. We have agents telling us that they could write a lot of people with a waiver that are currently sent to the high-risk pool. So we don't know, but we think it's worth trying it, and that's why the sunset is there, so the legislature can come back and look at what actually happens.
Yeah, because I personally, when I'm looking at with everything else that's happening in the realm of healthcare, the impact all of these things could have on OMIP could be rather large, and then the sustainability of that program may come into question here. So, I mean, you know, we're looking at all options at this point to try to deflect some of that.
Mr. Chair, the intent of the waiver is to, and I think John has stated it, is to actually decrease the number of members going into OMIP and keeping them in the commercial individual pool. The bottom of page 8, rate bands. Currently, a rate band, a health plan, and this is fairly general, but health plans file geographically adjusted rates called GARs. And then from there, we're no longer talking about individuals. We're talking about small groups, 2 to 50. So it's the employer world. For geographically adjusted rates, health plans can move their rates up or down based upon the age of the employer group as a whole, I believe. And that and family composition are the only two ways that you can adjust your rates. And a rate band allows you to move up X percent and down X percent. Right now in statute, there's a 2-to-1 rate band, which means if you start at 100%, you can go down 33% to roughly 67, or up 33% to roughly 133. And that's a rate band. What we've found is the 2-to-1 has been insufficient to maintain a stable small group market. And what HB 2987 proposes is a phase-in from 2 to 1 to 4 to 1. I believe back in the mid-90s, it was, I believe it was 4 to 1 and phased down to 2 to 1, and now we're proposing that it be phased back again. So July 1, 2004, it would move to 3 to 1, which would be starting at 150, down to 50 or up to 150, and then in July 2005, going to a 4 to 1, which we could go down to 40% and up to 160.
Mr. Chair, I'm totally lost. I don't understand what a rate band is.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tomei, a rate band is simply an upper and lower threshold in which the premium variances cannot go beyond. So in a 2-to-1, the rate for your lowest priced policyholder, once you establish that rate, no one can be above the other barrier or twice that amount. So it creates a rate band in which you have to put all of those you insure within that variance. What happens and what has happened over the last several years is that you've had to charge younger people, younger groups more and more in order to get enough premium from those other groups that would have, say, older people in it. The largest number of uninsureds come from the younger, small group market. What phasing in a broader rate band would allow would be get adequate premium from all insureds at a variance enough to get employers in a stable market to buy insurance. Right now, a lot of employers are subsidizing others.
Okay, if and I can follow up. So John, what group of insurers would be very young? Like
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tomei, a group of mechanics at a small automobile repair shop, for example.
They would be very young.
They could.
There might be then a similar group where most of the people would be older.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tomei, that is possible, yes. In any kind of mix, it's just that we find that the younger groups are those who tend to be without coverage.
So the idea of this is to create a wider band so that people who are younger who might be uninsured would be able to be insured because it would cost the employer less money.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tomei, that's correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, if I could just follow up on that as well. When you look at this, when you look at the small group market as a whole, you want a stable, viable market with healthy risks, unhealthy risks. You don't want a pool with just the unhealthy risks. So if you can get a good mix and keep the younger, healthier population in that pool, what we believe is that over time with the broader rate bands, you'll see overall rates being able to come down somewhat, or at least not increasing at the rate they have been, and we'll be able to get a broader mix of a broader population mix back into the pool. The participation credit, this would be a 5% credit offered to a small employer if all employees enroll. It's what this is. It's an incentive for more employees to participate, and it's what I was just explaining on the rate bands. It's trying to encourage both the healthy and unhealthy risks to join the pool. In insurance, we call just getting the unhealthy risks, we call that adverse selection. If somebody's really sick, they're going to want insurance. If somebody feels, if they feel untouchable or immune from sickness, they're not going to want insurance. They're going to decide to risk that that particular exposure. So what we're trying to do is get both avoid the adverse selection and provide an incentive for everybody in that employer's group to enroll. And again, this would apply to the small employers 2 to 50. On page 10, we've been talking about House Bill 2987, not before you today, but related is the moratorium on mandates, House Bill 2859. We believe this is all part of a package I've heard it stated before, and I like the phrase that this may not be a final solution or an end-all solution, but at least it gives health insurers another arrow or arrows in the quiver in dealing with this small market. We need more flexibility is what we're finding, and this will allow us to have some more flexibility. You'll be hearing next House Bill 3431, which would be another arrow in the quiver, so to speak. When last comment I'll make is, again, the big picture. There are a lot of forces coming down to bear on this small market. We've talked about premium increases, both from mandates as well as external premium increases just in the market. There's the cost shifting from government plans. Oregon Health Plan is a significant program in this state. And a viable small group market, individual market, is also critical for the Oregon Health Plan. There's an interrelationship hydraulics there that both plans need to be sustainable and healthy. And finally, we have at the federal level, some of you may be aware, others may not, association health plans. This is federal legislation that would make it very easy for employers to group up and purchase insurance that would circumvent state-regulated insurance requirements and mandates. If that happens, if you can see that with what commercial carriers subject to state regulation, you have the mandates and regulations and the small group restrictions, if at the federal level employers can jump into another market where you get rid of all of those restrictions, and many of them are good, not saying they're good or bad, but if you have two unequal playing fields, it's going to be another significant negative impact to the already deteriorating small group and individual market that we have. So we're trying to shore that up and make it more stable.
Questions?
But just thank you, Mr. Chair. On the we talked about the banding, the small group, and the 5% discount. If somebody worked, for example, I worked for the city partner for years, so I had really good insurance there. And so, if my wife worked for some small company, and they said, "We'll offer you this, you know, program, but you have to pay for it," she would say, "No thanks, because I'm covered by my husband's insurance." So then that employer would lose the 5% because he wouldn't have 100% of his people, the small employer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, yes, it would include all employees.
Thank you. Any questions? Go ahead.
Do you have anything? Do you want to add something or spirit? Okay.
Mr. Chair, my name is Dennis Tierney. Representative Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let me step back for a moment and provide a technical basis for what Lynn has presented to you. If you look at the data behind the insureds, and this comes from national information from an actuarial firm that publishes national data, fully 45% of the population have claims annually that do not exceed $200. 1% of the population have claims annually that exceed $25,000. And then in between, half of the population has varying amounts of claims, incidental to age, somewhat incidental to medical conditions, and so on. The purpose of this legislation is to allow the insurance carriers a mechanism in their pricing to attract back into the programs those people, those 45% of the population, that do not have claims exceeding $200. Again, two major insuring principles. One is the law of large numbers, and the second is a cross-section of risk. Without the good risk, we cannot sustain the losses of the people on the other end. So the purpose of this legislation is to find a way to attract back to the market those people that do not have the claims to help subsidize and hold the premiums for the rest of the population. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Doug Barber, Doug Stevenrick.
Here.
morning.
Good morning, Chair Cruz, members of the committee. My name is Doug Barber, here today representing the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters. The health underwriters have about 500 members in Oregon. These are independent insurance agents, consultants, employee benefits specialists, and health insurer carrier representatives. Our goal coming into this legislative session was to try to find some, at least some small ways that we could help make insurance more available and more affordable. And two of those concepts are incorporated in the bills you're hearing today. One of them is relaxing the rate band restrictions. That's incorporated in House Bill 2987. The other one has to do with flexibility and underwriting in the small insurance market, and that's the next bill on your agenda, 3431. Here today to help explain these concepts are Rick Rebel and Steve Doty. Both are health insurance agents here in the state with more than 20 years of experience each. I'll turn it over to Steve.
Okay. Since it appears you would prefer to talk about both of them, both of the bills at the same time, I mean, they do. I'm going to also open a public hearing on 3431, so we can talk about both of them.
So we can talk about everything. Yeah. Okay, that's fine.
Okay. Representative Cruz, members of the committee, my name is Steve Doty. I'm Vice President of Northwest Employee Benefits. I'm an independent insurance agent in the Portland area, specializing in the sale of group health insurance policies. I'm also a past president of the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters, and I'm here representing the association today in my testimony. With regard to House Bill 2987, there are three pieces to this, as you've already heard, and we support two of these pieces. The changes to the small employer plans, the rating, and the participation credits. And we oppose the individual one, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But to give you some background with regard to the rate banding, I know that concept is a little difficult to understand if you're not in the business. But what happened in 1995, Senate Bill 152 was passed, which created some major reforms in the small employer market. And one of the things that it did was to pool the rates so that the carriers were required to develop a geographic average rate for in a specific region. There are seven regions in the state of Oregon. So, for example, in the area of Portland, a carrier would have a specific geographic average rate, and then each individual employer would have a different rate based on the average age of those employees, and it could not be lower than the rate band or higher than the rate band. Initially, the rate band was 3-1, had a 50% variance, and that was changed a few years ago, so it was narrowed to the current rate band, which is a 2-1. And that, we feel, is too narrow, and we support the expanding of those rate bands. And I've shown in my testimony, if you have that in front of you, you'll see where I've used a hypothetical geographic average rate of $250 and what the low and the high rates would be for the current law and what it would be with the proposed changes, making it with a 50% variance and a 60% variance. You can see that there are trade-offs in doing this. When you expand these rate bands, you lower the rates for the younger population, but you're also increasing the rates for the higher population. But what we hope to accomplish with this is that by lowering the rates for the younger population, we hope to attract that population, which right now many don't insure because they're young and they feel they're bulletproof and they don't need insurance. They don't buy the insurance and choose not to enroll in their employer-sponsored plan. If we offer an attractive rate to these people, that will help, in theory, to lower the geographic average rate. So even though we're expanding it, and initially the older population will pay more over time as that geographic average rate is lowered, the rate for the older population will decrease as well. So we feel that this is an important thing that we do, is to expand these rate bands.
Could you go by that me again, how eventually the rate for the older people would lower?
Because the rate on the high end is tied. It can't be any more than under the current, if we were to change it to 50%, more than three times the average rate. If we bring that average rate down, then that brings that high rate band down as well. because it's all tied to the geographic average. And that the things that affect the geographic average rate is the pool itself. And if we increase the younger population...
Okay, then you have a larger pool, so eventually it'll come down.
Not only larger, but with a younger population, that population is typically a healthier population. And so we're expanding, bringing more bodies, a healthier population. That will bring down the average average cost.
Thank you.
The other part of this bill that we support are the participation credits. We feel that anything that we can do to allow credits for employers to help offset their rates, we would support. And this would also be an incentive for employers to enroll all of their employees in coverage. The one part of the bill that we oppose is the allowing of the individual exclusions, the specific exclusions for individual policies. There's a reason that they're prohibited now, and that was because prior to 1995, when Senate Bill 152 was passed, waivers were allowed, and it wreaked havoc in the marketplace. And because of that, we abolished them and said, and told the carriers they couldn't offer them anymore. This will take us back to those days. And the problem with individual waivers is that they are so broadly written that they create gaping holes in individuals' coverage that they don't realize they have. Because it isn't when a person indicates that they have a specific problem, the way the waiver is written, it expands it to exclude things that they think that the insured isn't aware that those things aren't excluded. It's related to those things. And so they have big holes in their coverage that they're not aware of. The other thing is that I don't see how this would lower enrollment into OMIP, because people who were issued a policy with a waiver are going to just go to OMIP anyway. So I don't think this solves the problem. Our solution is House Bill 3431. We do think we need to relax the underwriting requirements, because under current law, the carriers are required to accept, if they accept an application, they're required to issue any policy that they sell to the insured. And so they're very conservative in their underwriting practices, because they would assume that an individual with a health problem might want to buy the richest policy that they sell. What we are proposing under House Bill 3431 is to allow the carriers the flexibility to decline to issue certain policies, but to issue other policies that they may sell in their menu of products. So then, if they are rejected, if a person applies, let's say, for a $500 deductible, the carrier could say, we're not going to issue the $500 deductible, but we will issue a $1,000 deductible or some deductible in between. If the person, if that would constitute a rejection to allow them to go to OMIP if they choose to do that, but they could accept that higher deductible plan without specific waivers, and they might be willing to take that, knowing they have coverage for those conditions with just a higher copay. So we think that House Bill 3431 is a better alternative than the proposal as part of 2987. Thank you for your time.
Great. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rick Rebel. Sorry for the froggy throat this morning. But as Steve said, I concur with everything Steve said. Steve and I are on the front lines with our small employers, with those young employees watching the rates go up and are struggling with placing coverage. We're also on the front lines with folks trying to explain the waivers back from the old days. And as Steve said, they're many times very, very confusing. And I think we've gotten to the point now where I would struggle with this going backwards, as Steve said. I believe that all our alternative is better because it's easier to explain to a client that your deductible is X dollars, but we don't have to worry about which, if your knee's excluded or your high blood pressure is excluded. We're in the same environment. Now, I would also throw out that the possibility exists that it would be administratively simpler to continue down the same path that we're on right now without waivers and simply just apply appropriate deductible based on the person's state of health versus using waivers to control those costs. With respect to that small group market, I think it was Len that mentioned that the rates going up 18% to 20%. I can concur with that. The rates are going up 15-20% for all my small market. I will tell you that a lot of small employers are paying 50% of the premium now, where they were paying, as somebody previously said, 80% of the premium. The threshold for small employers is 50%. I think that the godsend currently is our FIAT program. I just placed 5 CNAs the other day with a small group that qualified for FIAT and could bring their families on the plan. Again, I think that helps spread the risk in the private market, bringing the averages down. So I would look to you for support of these proposals.
Representative Barker.
On the rate banning, lower prices for the younger people, will this not encourage, for example, City of Portland, allow retirees to buy in out of their own pocket in the health plan? I've heard in other committees where people have said, we've got to kick those retirees out because they're causing the overall price of the premiums to go up. So are we going to see a large amount of companies who have people who have spent their life 30 years working for somebody all of a sudden tell them, see you later, go buy your insurance somewhere else?
Chair Cruz, Representative Barker, I don't know if there's any evidence that that's happened in the market. I certainly haven't seen it in the clients that I represent. That, there's always a possibility that would happen. I'm not a labor lawyer, and I'm not sure. I think that'd be prohibited under labor law. But I certainly there's probably an incentive for an employer to hire younger people for the purpose of lowering their insurance costs. But that's not the only reason they hire people. That's just one. You know, when they hire somebody, they want to hire a good employee, and I think it would be very short-sighted for an employer to take that approach. That's why I doubt that that would happen very often.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, the discussion here is centered around the 2 to 25 market is where the rate bands exist, and there is a high amount of pressure, I think, right now on employers because the rate band is so compressed that there's a huge incentive now to hire younger people because anything you can do to bring those rates down would impact overall costs. So I think the expansion of the rate bands, bringing those younger people in there, will stabilize those pools of money and overall bring the geographic averages down.
Representative Tomei.
Right. Mr. Rebel, and 1, 2, 3, your fourth paragraph down, you mentioned if a kind of client applies for a $1,000 deductible plan, currently the client who applied for this can immediately send it back and ask for a $100 deductible plan, and the company cannot refuse them. Tell me more about that, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, that is correct. Currently, all carriers must guarantee that they'll issue any of their products. Basically, if they're going to issue one, they have to issue all of them.
This isn't a certain company.
For individual policies.
For individual.
Yes. And my thought is the carriers currently will defensively rate those policies knowing that they have to, no matter which one I want, you have to offer it if you accept me. The way the current laws are structured is that if you do apply for a $1,000 deductible plan and my underwriter says, well, we'll take the risk for a $1,000 deductible plan, my client can come back in within a window of time once the policy is issued, turn it back in and say, no, I've decided I want the $100 deductible plan, and the carrier has to issue that $100 deductible plan based on the previous underwriting.
Couldn't they charge a commensurate amount in premiums for that?
The rates are already pre-established in the contract. So now they're age-rated. So a 35-year-old $100 deductible plan is X dollars, and a $1,000 deductible plan is already rated lower. If I applied for the 1,000 and came back and said, I want the 100, I would just pay that $100 premium. But my underwriter maybe viewed me and my health based on the fact if I'm willing to take the first $1,000 of risk, I might be an okay risk, where they might have viewed me different if I was take one at a $100 deductible plan. And I believe that most of the underwriters, and I would defer to someone like Ruth to verify this, but I think that underwriters defensively and rate our plans because they know that no matter, they either take them or they reject them. And so no matter what they have, once they offer a policy, they have to offer all of their policies. And our bill basically says if you assess me and you feel comfortable in assuming the risk for a $1,000 deductible plan, that's the one you can make the offer of coverage on.
I think I understand. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ed.
I would like to pass something out for everybody to read, but I don't have copies. So.
All right, we can take care of that.
My name is Edward Johnston from Lincoln County. And this box right here contains my medical records dealing with my neck in 1989 when it was compressed disc to my neck where technically it's broken and they had to go in and take disc out and do surgery. I'm still fighting the workman's comp, the state of Oregon, and all the insurance companies dealing with this. This was an on the job injury. And it really frustrates me to see the insurance companies, the way this bill comes across to me, that this bill would be definitely a burden on the taxpayers of Oregon. I'm already dealing with the Oregon Health Plan at this point. My medical coverage ended today because I couldn't pay the premiums because I was on a job injury again and had spinal fusion a year ago. I just got the word Friday that they're going back in my neck for another surgery. My medical coverage from OMAP has been discontinued. I'm still fighting workman's comp. These insurance companies, the way they sit there and come up and say how they're working for the people and helping us, well, I'm a test to say they're not. So, I mean, right now I'm in the process of probably losing my home, everything else, not getting the assistance quotation that says the state's here to help. I paid my taxes. My family pays my taxes. This bill here will be a burden on not only that, but on my family's businesses, because they own their own business. This will affect private corporations, small business. This is just another an excuse for the insurance company to make higher profits and to affect the taxpayers to pay another outlet for them. If people are paying premiums, they are to be entitled for what they get, and I'll pass the buck along. And to me, it's extremely frustrating when I see this and listen to this, because right now I'm living basically on the life to death. I'm on one banana peel to the grave because of my neck. They're talking about, beside this surgery, another fusion. So it's very frustrating when I sit there and listen to how they say they're here to help when nobody gets to help. Dealing with a copy of this letter, this will explain. It is the one thing that frustrates me, seeing that we're talking about an insurance company dealing with OMAP, seeing that I've been pushed on to basically, most people would say the handout, the beggar program, or whatever way you want to call it, and I didn't have a choice on it. This is life. The one thing it says, dealing with my premiums, that I'm disabled and I shouldn't have to pay premiums. Well, I get my coverage lost because I am disabled. It's a catch-22, so where's the situation? All they're doing is passing one thing to another. You know, and the people like me down at the bottom totem pole are the ones who are affected. And the interesting thing, it could be your own family, friends, but then again, you just say, well, sorry, there's nothing we can do because it's the way it is. Well, today you have a control to say something that this is not the way it should be. You know, it's really frustrating for the injured worker to be suffering and losing his life and his family, which I have lost because of this, over this. So when you vote, please consider dealing with the families that could be affected not only outside of your own family, but what might be your own family down the road. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, Ed.
Thank you.
Committee, there, we will be revisiting these issues because I think they're critically important as we deal with our healthcare system and the adjustments we make in it to keep it affordable for the people of Oregon. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bills 2987 and 3431, and we are adjourned.